Welcome to the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Mover podcast series. Here you will get up close and personal with people who are taking giant steps for the betterment of cyclists and for the planet itself. We spent some time visiting with the amazing Renaissance man who has become the new USA manager for our National Bicycle Greenway Mayor's Ride Journey Across America with the Eagle, Bicycle, and our 40-foot support bus. Sean Raymond is an inventor, patent holder, engineer, mechanic, sculpture artist, and business founder who brushes the challenge our ride represents off as just another day at the office. So, Sean, how you doing today, guy?
Hey, pretty good, Martin. How's things going over there in Ireland?
Rainy?
Rainy?
Yeah, but I'm finding some great riding over here. I really am. And
any gold at the other end of the rainbow?
Well, I can't. Well, perhaps. How's that for an answer?
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah. Hey, let's talk about bikes. Let's talk about Sean Raymond as he relates to bikes, and in particular, okay, the National Bicycle Greenway. So I'm going to talk about you and let people know about this amazing man that I've had good fortune of meeting in my life, and I want to know about you. I want to help my listeners know about you. Let's talk about Palo Alto for just a second as a way of introducing you, because you're homegrown from there.
Right.
Besides being known as the birthplace of radio as well as of the Silicon Valley, Palo Alto long has reigned as one of the top biking cities in the nation. I mean, the legendary Yopes Brandt, the author of the timeless bestseller, The Bicycle Wheel, and the inventor of the Avocet bike computer, et cetera, who we will soon have on our show, was leading rides all over the nearby Coast Range. And then you got Ellen Fletcher, you know, America's most probably celebrated bike activist, who established respect for that calling, and who we podcasted before, she was powering away over there in Palo Alto. Palo Alto Bikes was huge in the national bike scene. America's first bike boulevard was coming online, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. During this time, were you much involved with biking then as a kid?
Yeah. You know, we always wanted, you know, around, well, I was involved in bicycles, repairing bicycles when I was seven. And I think from that point on, I was always trying to put 10-speed parts or aluminum parts from different bikes onto my bike and my friends' bikes. And we were always in the, you know, mode of making our bikes better. And I guess when we were teenagers, we were kind of making bicycles that were more like motorcycles. And we'd take the fenders off, and we'd put knobby tires on it, and we would do jumps, and we would ride out in the mud and stuff. And I remember going to South San Francisco area up there in those mountains back there and going on what was to be some of the first mountain bike competition with a three-speed bike with knobby tires, and all these guys had 10 speeds with knobby tires, and it was quite an interesting, you know, it was the beginning of mountain bikes, and it was, you know, the two kind of melded together, the three-speed bike and the 10-speed bike, and now we got the mountain bike.
So, but as far as Palo Alto, what was going on for you then? Were you much around the scene? I mean, it was just alive. There was John Forrester, the guy who's really the man who gave the League of American Women the book that they used to kind of certify their instructors. He was busy in Palo Alto. They were building bike lanes just all over, everywhere. Stanford was going crazy. What do you remember about that time?
Well, I guess, I mean, I saw all the bike lanes go in. And, you know, it was kind of nice, dude. We were now, you know, kind of equivalent to cars. We could ride off of the sidewalk along the side of the car. That was kind of neat. You know, Palo Alto's pretty flat, and as a result, you know, you can ride for a long distance without a lot of effort. We used to go to Stanford as kids and ride around and out in the Baylands. And, it was a lot of freedom, you know.
Okay. Well, in addition to it being very excited about bikes, and a lot of people might not know this, but Palo Alto really it almost could be arguably called the startup capital of the world. You know, it's long served as an incubator for many national and international companies. Companies that started in Palo Alto include Hewlett Packard, Google, Facebook, Xerox, Logitech, Sun Microsystems, PayPal, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, it's been said that as the startup capital of the world, that a lot of the push in Palo Alto was to kind of have a company raise it to a certain level and then go public with it. You know, you had your venture capitalists that were kind of being pushed through the mill by Stanford, and it seemed like there was some spillover into the education system. And could you not help but feel this push when you were a kid growing up there?
Well, my dad was involved in electronics. He worked for first Lockheed in plasma physics, and then up at HP Labs, and he was working on materials that were higher performance than silicon, which is what most chips are made out of. And as a kid, I just thought that was a normal thing that, you know, you had ideas and you just, you know, you started a company. I started a very small company manufacturing high frequency circuits for telecommunications. I used to guesstimate maybe more of a like marketing a guesstimation that made me look good, but I used to say that about 10% of all long distance phone calls went across circuits that I had etched. This may or may not be the case, but it was a pretty good guesstimation. So I was immersed in the startup world and saw that there was all kinds of things that we could do. There was like no, you know, we really didn't have a limit. You know, the limit really was is your ability to be able to convince people who had money that your technology was going to be the next $100 million, you know, corporation.
Okay, so essentially you realize what could almost be called the Palo Alto dream. You were in your 20s, I think it was, and you were making what, six figures? With a lot more on,
Yeah,
yeah.
the first year I was in business, I was making more than my dad by a considerable amount, and he was a senior staff scientist. And so things looked really good for me. I developed electronics technology that was to replace printed circuit board, and did some testing at Mayo Clinic with it. It ended up testing at the highest electrical capabilities of any interconnect they had ever tested, short of optics. That technology is really waiting for me to figure out how to convince venture capital that I have the next $100 million corporation. I'm still working on my skills to be able to do that. It's not
Okay.
really, it's not the technology isn't really the limiting factor. It's really my ability to put together a convincing package.
Okay. Well, what happened to the company that was making 10% of all long-distance phone calls? What happened to them? What happened to your, yeah?
My major customer went bankrupt when FCC allowed HBO to scramble the signal, and it took a number of years before they came back into business. And by that time, the bean counters figured out a different way to make the circuits that I was making, but they had a lot lower performance, and they saved 30 cents per circuit, but they gave up $5 in sale price. So, you know, I don't think they realized that's what they were doing, but you know, it took 10 years for me to realize what they had done. It was a very much a niche market who I was selling to, mm-hmm. and why.
And you sold millions of these, is that correct?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, tens of millions.
Tens
of
millions
things.
All over the world? Wow.
Well, they were sold primarily. They were a very important part that was sold through this company.
Well, I want to talk about the Marines. You joined the Marines. You don't seem to me, I've never thought of you as being a macho Marlboro man. I've thought of you always as being kind of a very cerebral, very thinker type of guy. What was going on there? Usually I think of a Marine, well, he's trying to prove his manhood.
Yeah, well, my grandfather was in the First World War as an officer, and he was in the Marines. And then my dad, it was the Korean War, and so he went in as a Marine. And so Vietnam was just going on while I was in the beginning of high school. And my dad had the brilliant idea of sending me to Annapolis. Now, I didn't have grades good enough to get into Annapolis, but it started the idea of going to the Marine Corps to get electronic school, which I got radar school, and I repaired radar to the component level.
Hmm.
I knew immediately, I went in as a reserve. I was a year and a half active duty and then a year and a half as a reserve, and then I was able to get myself out of there. I saw it as the kind of older serious Boy Scouts. And,
yeah. Huh.
Yeah.
Wow.
The Marine Corps really wasn't the place for, I think, my type of personality.
You talk about your dad and his influence on you and joining the Marines. And you talked a little bit about the fact that he was involved I can't exactly remember the exact words you used, plasma physics or what?
Yeah.
And so that's why he became what brought him to the Palo Alto incubator, I guess? Where was he from originally before that?
Well, he grew up in Pacific Grove over there, you know, near Monterey.
Oh, Monterey, okay.
Yeah, okay. His father was a civil engineer for the Army.
Mm-hmm.
And he was like one of the first in the class of reinforced concrete out of Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
So the Civil Corps of Engineering had him, you know, all around in all kinds of construction projects.
Mm-hmm.
But they pretty much were in Pacific Grove. My dad is a pretty sharp cookie, and he liked the tech stuff, and he's quite the scientist and quite the developer of microwave products. Actually, he designs very high-tech antennas for medical use right now.
Huh.
They have a pill that looks at your intestines as it goes down through your body,
mm-hmm.
and the signal is transmitted out of your body, and that's no easy feat to be able to receive the signal that comes out of this pill,
mm-hmm.
you know, because there are various densities of your body.
Mm-hmm.
So that's just, you know,
that's
one of the things.
That's something your dad invented?
He's working on the antennas, and uh-huh. they weren't able to make them work until he came on board.
Wow. Wow. So,
yeah.
You're chip off the old block and then some, huh? I'm kind
well,
of
well, yeah. I
I'm getting a
I think my mom
you.
Is actually may be the smarter of the three of us.
Oh, really?
But, okay. Yeah, she's a very talented, very intelligent woman.
Hmm.
But my dad and I are the ones that, you know, have been out working in the industry. So.
Uh-huh, uh-huh. Wow. Well, you've also worked on a lot of cars during your years, and you restored a car most mechanics know to stay away from because it requires such a high degree of specialized knowledge. Tell us about your BMW, the one you rebuilt from the ground floor up.
Yeah, I got this. Well, I've been working on cars since I was 12, with my dad, initially, and then, on all my friends' projects when I was a teenager. Yeah, I got a 2001 BMW that had a blown motor, and I replaced that. And I noticed that BMW does things that make it difficult for mechanics, things that require special tools, something as simple as just the starter, which is normally just bolted in with two bolts for all car makers. But BMW has this locating pin that's a press fit. And of course, the bolts won't just press it in. You have to have a special tool to press it in. So I think I spent probably half a day discovering this. That's why it starts to go in. And so I just took a drill and just drilled out the locating hole so that the it was no longer a press fit. It just kind of it was like very, very loose fit, and I basically used the bolts to locate the position of the starter, and it worked perfectly, and there was no unusual starter noise when you'd start the car. But this was just a great example of BMW going out of its way to make it difficult for your neighborhood corner mechanic.
Oh, it's a beautiful machine. I must say that about your car. Not
you
being a
have
car guy.
to give it to BMW. I mean, this is a BMW 3 Series, and it's there's no, driving this car, there's no small wonder why it's been car of the year for like 10 years in a row. It's
Jeez. But you pretty much had to kind of go through almost everything, huh, on that automobile.
Well, I had to put a clutch in, and I had to. First, I thought I could repair the blown head gasket, but I tore the whole head off of the thing, which isn't easy to do while it's still in the car, and then realized it was too far gone. Had to pull the motor out and put another motor in. It's like solving any problem. It's just a matter of time and effort and sweat.
Yeah, and that's what makes you a perfect bicycle mechanic because you bridge the
Yeah.
gap between bikes and cars. And my own self, my own experience, I know from having worked on Austin Healey's and Triumphs and cars like that when I was in college as a way to get through college, I have major respect for your skills. I mean, I know when I started getting into the restoring a Mercedes-Benz, it was way out of my league, and I got it all together, but it wasn't a happy exercise. And you've got that BMW, it's like runs like a top, blows my mind.
I still have a Jaguar XKE that I had in college
Wow.
that I had saved. It was rotting in someone's driveway, and it's a 62 XKE, and
It's funny you
I
should say Jaguar.
rehabilitated that.
It's funny you say Jaguar because a friend of mine, Bob Beaudry, and I, we were going to buy a Jaguar. In fact, I don't know exactly how it all worked out, but it was going to involve an airplane as part of the deal and all this blah de blah. I don't know if he bought it or something like that, but I just chickened out. I was afraid of it. It scared me.
Oh,
It scared me.
yeah, it is a difficult car to work on. Very, very tight.
Yeah,
There's
jeez.
just not a lot of room. Everything is shoehorned in there.
Tell me about this bike you're inventing.
Yeah, it's a tandem bicycle that is the length of a regular bicycle. The short rider rides up front, basically on the handlebars, but there's a seat nestled in the handlebars, essentially. I'm on my 15th prototype of it. I've been riding, I can ride a 200-pound rider on the front, and I can ride, a 8-year-old kid.
15th prototype.
Yep. Yep. It's probably been working on it about 4 years.
Oh, my God. 15th. I've seen some of your early versions, and then I've seen some of your later versions. I hadn't realized that it's been 15 times. I thought maybe 3 or 4 or 5 times, but 15. My God. That means it's been a completely different machine each time you come around.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, I've done some very radical things to it. Just recently in the last few months, maybe 3 or 4 months ago, I realized that most of my problems were all due to a lot of looseness in the construction of the bearings that are up in the front. And so the whole fork felt, basically the whole bike felt loose and it felt unstable. And it was really more due to my very quick prototyping. I really went out of my way to, build it in a much more sturdy manner so that the bearings didn't all wiggle around. Voila, everything worked great. Now it feels real stable up front.
Okay, and then when you say prototype, I think what my listeners need to understand is that you're not just inserting your own fabrications of parts or things like that. You're actually getting in and you're redoing welds, you're brazing, you're doing a lot of press fits. You're like almost like a blacksmith on this thing.
I had to make my own hubs. I had to make my own forks. I had to basically change all the frame angles. I had to stretch the frame a little bit. It's technically the bike is the length of a cruiser bike, like a beach cruiser. It's 43.5 inches. Axle to axle.
Jesus.
So wow. It's not that long. A tandem, I think, is about 70 inches. A very short tandem is maybe 70 inches from axle to axle, if I'm not mistaken. And, you know, it's the difference between driving a moving truck to go get, some groceries versus driving a regular car.
You know, when I caught you today, you're over at the Redwood City Harbor, and you were picking up a piece, scouting, I guess, a scrapyard for a piece of brass?
Bronze.
What's the difference between bronze and brass? Is it bronze is what the brass becomes?
No, it's... brass is the thing that most of us see, that's kind of gold looking. And that has got tin and copper, or zinc and copper. Tin and zinc are silver metals, and they're cheap. Mm-hmm. And so they mix that with the copper, and it makes it a golder color, and it also is cheaper. Bronze is... about 98% copper and 2% silicon, like sand.
Okay.
That small amount of silicon kind of somehow lightens up the copper color. So it's slightly gold. But that is the material that... for millions of years, maybe 10,000 years, people have been using to make statues up with.
Okay, and now, once again, we're gonna leave bicycles, we're going to leave automobiles, and we're going to leave electronics. We're going to talk about another thing that another art form that occupies your amazing talents and energies. Tell us about this bronze sculpture that you have on YouTube that's getting all kinds of praise.
Yeah, it's a woman's face with flying hair. It's kind of like on the bow of a ship, they used to have a whole woman, maybe with flying hair, usually a naked woman, the spirit of the ship. And my idea was really to focus on the flying aspect. I always looked at it as the woman was flying across the waves, flying in the air, flying through the breeze. And so I wanted to take this woman's face and have her hair kind of blowing in the background. And then I wanted to add kind of a modern touch to it, and I extremely angulated the face. So, people kind of noticed the natural flats or angles in people's faces, maybe the triangles that are in the face. So I kind of accentuated that. So as a result, it's there's a lot of reflections in the face, as well as stylized the hair to have flats so that they also reflect.
Sean, I'm not sure I understand the connect between nuts and bolts and engineering and mechanics and art. Can you explain that for us?
There's quite a lot of engineering in doing the casting process. I watched the casting process when I was a kid. My dad and his friends used to make lead soldiers with silicon rubber molds, and they would melt lead on the stove in the kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
And so I watched that process, and then I got involved in it in high school, not in lead soldiers, but in casting jewelry and other things. And I had a teacher who tried to keep me from going in the Marine Corps. He got me a $10,000 commission to make some high-end plumbing fixtures for some multi-million-dollar house being built on the Palo Alto Hills. I think he knew something that I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
about where I needed to be in this world, and it's taken years for me to realize that maybe that's the place for me.
Wow. Okay. So the engineer, business founder, mechanic, car mechanic, bike inventor that you are, your mechanical aptitude is just, it's beyond over the top. I mean, on the Eagle, on my high wheel, I'm going to be taking across the nation here pretty soon. I've seen you solve some of the problems that have cropped up on it, that I've had big mailing lists from people over the nation telling me, with suggesting really complicated fixes. And you'll come in with these solutions that are almost like so simple, it's like they came from the barnyard or something like that. Like my spokes that were loose right up almost to the day I was ready to leave for Salt Lake. At the last moment, you came up with the idea for shoe goo, you know? And then, my front wheel was almost touching the back wheel instead of all this complicated machinery and presses and things like that. You made kind of a lever out of a rope and 2x4s that pulled it back out to normal.
Right.
That's just some of the fixes. Where do aha's, ideas like this come from, Sean?
I don't know. I try to look for simple solutions relative to what I have at hand. And, I had to do that as a kid working on my bike. I didn't necessarily have the extra little parts that would make these components fit. So I would take look at a nut or a bolt or a washer and figure out if I could bend it and drill a hole in it, and if I could file this and file that, and I could make it work. So I really worked at trying to take what I currently had and figure out how to make it, do what I needed it to do. And so, like bending the frame on the bike, I realized that it just needed to be bent back. and that if it was easy enough for you to have bent while you were riding it, mm-hmm. hanging wheelies or hitting curbs or something like that, that I thought that, you know, we could get a big wood lever and just tie it to the front fork, and I literally just put my foot on the bike and pulled hard on the lever, and just to see how much effort it would take to bend a little, and lo and behold, we were able to bend it right there. So it made me look like a genius. If I think that board was shorter, I wouldn't look so smart. Fortunately, the board was long enough.
Right, right. A big enough lever. Right, exactly.
Right.
Jeez, wow. Well, I imagine that some of the fixes ahead of us are going to really get keep you scratching your head as we take the Eagle, the bus, and the bus go. We get that from here to the East Coast. Are you looking forward to those challenges? Like, even if you're not with us physically, of coaching us through some of the mess that may crop up?
Oh yeah, you know, we're going to get that thing tuned up real good. So I feel good that it's going to make it. I saw, you know, the condition it was in, and it made it past Salt Lake City.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, I have an idea of how tuned up it's got to be to make the trip.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, anything that crops up along the way, you know,
so a lot, a lot of preemptive work.
Yeah, you we're know. Basically just going to do some good maintenance on the thing, right. and for any kind of problems that are about to break.
Yeah, yeah, and I hope we see those ahead of time on the bus and the bicycle, you know, so I know that with your eagle eye, we're not going to miss very much. Sean, is there anything you'd like to add?
No, I think you've covered my life pretty completely.
Well, I know there's a lot more, Sean. And I think you're just being humble. But I think with that said, probably I should just let both of us get back to some of our more demanding things that are going on in this world. But I'm so excited to be able to kind of introduce to America, as it were, the man who's going to be managing the effort, National Bicycle Greenway effort, to get from San Jose, San Francisco, to Washington, D.C., Boston in the summer of 2011, and possibly as well the summer of 2012.
Well,
so thanks, Sean.
You're welcome, and you know, you're going to be the one that's doing most of the work. So, I'm more than happy to help you, achieve your goals, and show the world and the United States and the locals in every little town you go that the bicycles are empowering, and then you can go 2 miles, or you could go 20 miles, or you could go 2,000 miles.
Awesome. Awesome. All right, John. Well, thanks for you, guy.
All right. Good talking to you, Martin.
Talk to you soon, man. Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay. Right. Bye-bye.
That wraps up another edition of the National Bicycle Greenway's Mountain Movers podcast series. We hope you enjoyed it. This has been NBG Director and Awake Again author Martin Krieg. To access this podcast in the future and to hear other shakers and movers that we've interviewed, go to bikeroute.com.